Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
So this is the panel on global logistics, and I'm Richard Applebaum. I'll moderate the panel. I'm a professor of sociology and global and international studies here at UCSB. And I like to think that I got Nelson partly launched in this interest in containers because he and I and his wife Eileen Boris and my wife visited the Yantian International Container Terminal in Shenzhen, China, 2 years ago. And that experience, I guess, stuck with Nelson quite deeply. So what I'd like to do is first introduce the four panelists in the order in which they'll be speaking, and then my principal role will be a timekeeper and moderator. Paula Hamilton is a doctoral student in the Department of Geography at Queen Mary College, University of London. She came the longest distance, and since this is about logistics, we're having her go first. On her day job, she is a researcher at the International Transport Federation. Her work explores the growth of the global logistics industry, its role in the world economy, and the implication of changes in that sector for employment and industrial relations in the transport industry on land, sea, and air. Her talk will be entitled DHL Global Logistics, A Geographer's Perspective. She will be followed by Andrew Herod, who is professor of geography and adjunct professor of international affairs and of anthropology at the University of Georgia. That's Georgia in the United States, so he did not come quite as far as Paula. He is author of Labor Geographies, Workers, and the Landscape of Capitalism. He's editor of Organizing the Landscape, Geographical Perspectives on Labor Unionism, and co-editor of The Dirty Work of Neoliberalism, Cleaners and the Global Economy, and An Unruly World, Globalization, Governance, and Geography. His talk is entitled Containers, Contracts, and Geography, Responding to Technological Innovation Through Remaking the Labor Landscape. Andrew will be followed by Peter Payton, who is Secretary of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, Local 63. He is a working longshoreman in Los Angeles and a co-chair of the ILW's Port Security Committee. His talk is entitled Labor and Logistics in a Global Industry. And finally, Alan Sekula, who you heard from last night, writer, critic, and filmmaker. His books include Photography Against the Grain, Fish Story, Titanic's Wake, and Performance Under Working Conditions. His films include Tsukuji, The Lottery of the Sea, and A Short Film for Laos. He teaches in the Photography and Media program at the California Institute of the Arts. His talk is The Aesthetics of a Containerized World. So we'll begin with Paula.
Okay, so good morning, everyone, and thank you for my invitation. I'm very happy to be in California at this time of the year. It's good, teamwork. Okay, so I'm going to talk about a company called DHL XL Supply Chain, and this is part of a wider research project, and the paper draws upon observations at a number of different facilities in Germany, Hong Kong, the USA and the UK, and also in-depth interviews with senior management throughout the company. The majority of the interviews are actually within particular sectors, so within the automotive contract logistics division and within the fast-moving consumer goods division. So, what am I going to cover? Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about how DHL XL Supply Chain came into being. I'm going to look at some perspectives on analyzing the contemporary global economy from a chains and networks perspective. And then I'm going to go into some of the results from my research findings. And that's looking at the types of contracts this company is winning and the scales at which these contracts operate. Issues around power and control and inter-firm relationships, and I'm going to particularly focus on the client and contract logistics provider relationship. And then I'm going to look at the influence of non-firm actors within global production networks, and for that I'm going to focus on the role of trade unions in shaping production networks and the logistics supply the logistics activities within those networks. So, DHL XL Supply Chain is actually part of a company called Deutsche Post WorldNet, which started its life as the German Post Office. It currently employs, as an organization, over 500,000 workers directly, of which over 150,000 are situated within DHL XL Supply Chain. And it also has, within its the way the company is structured, there is a logistics division, and that's where the freight forwarding operations under DHL Global Forwarding are placed, and the contract logistics is placed under DHL XL Supply Chain. And as is probably familiar from yesterday and this morning, the evolution of these companies has basically been through a series of acquisitions. So in this case, Deutsche Post, the post office, bought DHL, Danzas, and XL. And about a year and a half prior to the purchase of XL purchased Tubin & Britain, which is another huge logistics company. And just to emphasize the geographical perspective of this, DHL, which I'm just going to call it DHL from now on because it's just too much of a mouthful. It has physical operations in 41 countries, and I think that's a very important point to make because rather than seeing globalization as a sort of flat thing, I think it's very important that we understand it's extremely geographically uneven. And the fact that a company like DHL, which has the capacity to perform operations pretty much anywhere, only concentrates physical operations in 41 countries is a very significant point that we shouldn't forget. So it provides services for a range of clients in the automotive, life sciences and healthcare sectors, consumer, retail, technology, engineering and manufacturing and chemical. So it pretty much covers most of the different sectors in the global economy. Its clients tend to be the major manufacturing and retail transnational corporations in the world, including companies like Ford, General Motors, Procter & Gamble. So those are the kind of clients they deal with. And they provide a very wide range of logistics services, which I've just outlined up here. So, as we're all aware, containerization has played a fairly important role in the development and emergence of integrated or door-to-door logistics providers such as DHL XL Supply Chain. Technological advancements, both in terms of communications and the invention of things like the jet engine, has also generated, again, these companies' development. And as has been discussed in several presentations, what I would call re-regulation rather than deregulation has been a process that has been extremely important in their development. And finally, the diversification of both companies within the transport sector and external to the transport sector have been extremely important in the emergence of these huge logistics providers. And I just want to give you an example of a couple of them. So we have Deutsche Post WorldNet, and its contract logistics division is DHL XL Supply Chain. It emerged from the postal sector. Kuhne & Nagel, another huge contract logistics company, emerged from the freight forwarding sector. A.P. Møller-Mærsk, with its Maersk Logistics, emerged from the shipping sector. Kerry Properties, which is the direct or immediate parent company of Kerry Logistics, is a property development company. Li & Fung Group is a trading company. And Deutsche Bahn, which is the, not that I want to emphasize Europe in this, but is the German railway, and is therefore a rail operator, has an enormous contract logistics division, which includes basically, as you will see, through an acquisition process, both first Schenker, then Stennes, and finally Bax Global. So it's now a major competitor to DHL XL Supply Chain as well. So the final factor in the emergence of these logistics companies has been the disaggregation of production. So the emergence of more sophisticated and complex production networks over larger geographical distance has increased the need for these companies to become more active and to grow in terms of the global economy. So I want to do, this is my theory slide, there's only one, so don't worry. So how do we look at where these companies fit in? Well, one way of looking at them is through a network perspective, and there are a number of different frameworks that have been developed. The first one is the Global Commodity Chains framework, which whose most famous advocate is Gareffi. Then you have Global Value Chains perspective, which has emerged from the Institute for Development Studies at the University of Sussex and MIT over here in the States. And then you have the Global Production Networks framework, which is mainly associated with the Manchester University, and in particular Hess, Dickin, Coe, Henderson, and Young. So basically, the three frameworks at the core are fairly similar. They're based on the nexus of interconnected functions, operations, and transactions through which a specific product or service is produced, distributed, and consumed. But there are differences, and the two main differences are, in terms of global commodity chains and value chains, they are essentially linear structures. And the Global Production Network framework attempts to go beyond that. And the second difference is basically that the first two frameworks are very narrowly focused on inter-firm governance, transactions, and relationships, whereas the Global Production Networks framework attempts to go beyond that and encompass relevant sets of actors and relationships beyond the inter-firm perspective. However, there are gaps in this framework, and there are a number of areas that are underdeveloped. In particular, each of these frameworks has kind of forgotten about logistics. I think that's the blunt way. How everything moves through these networks or chains or whatever you want to call them. The second is that they treat firms within their analysis as homogeneous entities and do not look with inside the firm at inter-firm or intra-firm relationships. And the third bit is that the area of work that tends to be underdeveloped is looking at role of non-firm actors such as the state, civil society organizations, labor, and so on. So, moving on to the more interesting bit. This is a breakdown of the different forms of contracts that I observed during my research. And you will see that they are different types of contracts to begin with. So we have a lead logistics provider contract, which I'll talk about first. And basically, this type of contract involves the coordination of other logistics providers involved in a client's outsourced logistics function. It serves as the client's primary supply chain management provider, defining processes and managing the provision and integration of logistics services through its own organization and those of other subcontractors. So the contract that I observed operated at a European scale. It involved the coordination of 25 different logistics providers and warehouse operators within the European region, and the coordination of the movement of components from 1,500 different suppliers into all four of Europe's facilities within the European Union. It operated, in this case, DHL did not provide any physical facilities it utilized the client's facilities. So it had an office within Ford of Europe's facility in Cologne. Its staff were based there. It had no overheads in terms of paying for office space or anything like that. It was intimately connected to different departments within Ford of Europe's facility in Cologne. And obviously, as I mentioned, it coordinated the activities of other transport and warehouse operators. The second one I've called International Import and Export, and this is a multi-regional contract. And interestingly, this again was about the movement of components into another into Ford's facilities in multiple regions. However, it was... Sorry, I've lost my space a bit. In this situation, DHL did provide physical facilities, so it did operate its own warehousing and cross-dock operations. And in doing so, it was also able to meet the needs of more than one client from that facility. So whilst DHL was servicing Ford's operations internationally from this facility, it was also servicing General Motors and some of the major suppliers in the automotive sector. Okay. The other interesting thing about this is that DHL's position within this production network that it held the contract in was significantly different from the lead logistics provider contract. In this case, it was under the coordination of another lead logistics provider who was one of its major competitors in the automotive contract logistics sector. In the third situation, we go to a very different scale. We go down to a very local scale. In this case, the company had a contract to perform the in-house operations within an assembly facility for Jaguar in the UK. So it basically coordinated local suppliers' movements into the facility at the same time as managing the in-house logistics requirements. So it was responsible for getting the right components to the right assembly worker on the right line within the facility. And in this situation, obviously, it didn't need to have its own facilities. And the final one is operating at a subnational basis and is a distribution contract. So this was a contract with EverReady, so batteries, very important. And it was a contract that was held in southeast region of the US. In this case, DHL provided its own facilities on what it called its campus, which was outside Atlanta, Georgia. So basically, this was a concentration of logistics activities for multiple clients on a campus-like basis, a bit like Santa Barbara at the university. And in this case, it also coordinated the transport movements of other carriers to the clients, customers, who were major companies like Target, etc. So this is just to give you a flavor of the different geographical scales at which logistics contracts are awarded and the capacity for companies like DHL, XL to transfer and operate across multiple scales. So the importance of making these contracts successful is very much about establishing a positive working relationship with the client and other firms operating in the production network. And what I want to do now is to briefly look at the most clearly defined relationship, which is that between the client and the logistics provider. And what you see here is in these two quotes from interviews with senior managers in the company, is a very wide spectrum of relationships and power and control. So in some circumstances, these companies like DHL are able to establish, whilst they can't have an equal relationship with their client, they have a very big degree of autonomy and the capacity to interact with them in a more collaborative way than is normally sort of depicted. So in the situation in Hong Kong, they had very positive and well-established relationships with transnational corporations. But when they conducted business with Chinese firms in the Shenzhen and Pearl River Delta region, it was very much a case of this is an economic transaction and that's it, end of story. So there's a definite distinction in terms of their client base and the types of power relations that are occurring. And the second quote is actually from the US. And in this situation, DHL had a contract with a huge transnational corporation for around 10 years. So they'd had a long working relationship together. And during that time, DHL had attempted to move beyond the services that it was contracted for. But time and again, they were kind of kicked back by their client and said, no, this is it. That's all we want you to do. So they weren't able to expand the range of services or their relationship beyond the remit of their contract in that situation. However, in the automotive sector, DHL has is pretty much the dominant company in terms of contract logistics. It only really has one or two other major competitors who could compete for business with transnationals. And it's also very well established in the UK market. So in this situation, you see their dominance within the automotive sector combined with their concentration of activities and dominance within a national market. And in this situation, they're actually able to work towards collaboration, not just with their client, but with multiple clients and across those clients. So this is a very interesting dynamic in terms of the position of a logistics provider within a production network, because actually what they're doing is pulling in several places or positions within multiple production networks to work together, even though they're actually technically competing. Another interesting thing that is happening is that you kind of don't think about logistics providers being financiers. And this is another example of where a company within, or a firm within a production network is basically attempting to upgrade its position within that network. And given the parent company that DHL has, which also has a bank, you can see the synergies both within Deutsche Post, the parent company, but you can also see how a company like DHL is able to push its way further and further into the client's more traditional areas. So it's a long way from being a warehouse operative to being the financier of parts of supply chains. So that's kind of looking at some of the aspects between its client and itself. What I want to do now is to start to look at how trade unions actually influence the activities within a company like DHL, which has extremely low unionization rates, I have to point out. So the only two of the nine facilities I went to had any form of unionization. And one was in the UK, one was in the US. Both, strangely enough, were in the automotive sector. So you can see a correlation there between the industry that their clients coming from, unionization in that industry, and the capacity for workers to unionize within the logistics provider who's servicing such clients. So a number of factors came out in terms of my analysis of DHL and organized labor. One is, obviously, as I've just discussed, the very uneven geographies of organized labor within DHL itself. The second area was the capacity for organized labor either within the company or associated with the client or other actors within the production network to restrict DHL's capacity to deliver contracts and to heighten the risk in terms of service delivery. The third, as I've mentioned, is the unevenly impact. It's unevenly impacted by unionization, both within clients and with industry sectors that it services. And the final bit is that, again, organized labor is particularly concentrated at certain scales within a company like DHL. So this was a quote from quite a senior manager. Sometimes the white tape of a union environment can stop you implementing new ideas or suggestions either as quick as you'd like, or you're simply not going to get them off the ground. And when he was referring to this, he was not necessarily referring to his own workforce. In this case, he was referring to his client's workforce and the capacity for them to shape what the company itself could do. And this second one is from the US, and again is making it pretty clear. This company does not want unions inside its activities. And what was very clear from the analysis is that it will go to great lengths to remain what it calls union-free. And again, this quote quite clearly demonstrates the importance of unionization within the sectors that it services. So the final one, which I'm quite interested in, is actually the extent to which unions have been able to impact and to unionize within a company like DHL. Because as a contractor to multiple clients, it's quite a challenge for unions to actually be able to have any form of unionization within the logistics sector or the contract logistics sector, whatever you want to refer to it as. But what you find is that the company is very clearly, where it has to accept that workers want to unionize, it's doing it at the most atomized scale it can possibly get away with. So it's either on a site-by-site basis or at the most a contract-by-contract basis. And it's very clear that it's unwilling to engage in any form of bargaining processes with unions or with its workforce at a national or at a supranational scale. And clearly for the transport unions, who are extremely fragmented already and not particularly good at cooperating even at a national scale, this creates a huge challenge when you're dealing with a company that has 150,000 workers and you then multiply that by three to actually get the extent of the workers involved in the contracts it holds. So I'm just kind of laying the ground a little bit for Andy. And then just a clear idea, it clearly analyzes the different national contexts and the different unions. So it profiles these companies. And then I just want to finish off with this quote, which really kind of demonstrates the power that logistics companies have in shaping production networks. But it also demonstrates the power that organized labor has within logistics companies without them actually realizing it, and also within the greater production network itself. So I just wanted to finish with that quote because I thought it was quite meaningful, and hopefully I haven't gone over time too much.
Thank you, Paula. Andy?
Again, as Paula said, I'd like to thank the organisers for inviting me to come speak today. And what I want to do is to talk a little bit about a historical story related to organising and contract bargaining on the East Coast with dockers. And then if I don't go over time, maybe try and think about some lessons that that might hold for us in the contemporary period. So the title of my talk, I originally had a much different title, but Nelson said, give us something a bit sexier. So I tried to come up with something a bit sexier. So containers, contracts, and geography. Maybe that says something about my idea of sexy, I don't know. But responding to technological innovation through remaking the labor landscape. So I wanted to start off actually with a couple of quotes from a couple of East Coast union officials to really get us thinking about issues of labor from a geographical perspective. Some of you might be wondering why there are actually two geographers here today talking about labor. What I hope to do is to get you thinking about how the issue of work, of contract bargaining, of labor markets, there are many things, but one of the things is that they're deeply geographical processes and entities. So I think these two quotes kind of bring this home. So the first is from Tony Scotto, who had been the president of one of the ILA locals in Brooklyn. And this is from the, both these quotes are from the 1960s. He said, the industry's oldest and deepest conflicts center in customs and practices, in work rules and cargo handling methods, habits that vary widely from port to port, creating multiple contradictions and needless fragmentation. A national agreement, identical in all major provisions, would gradually erode industrial anarchy, would curb or halt wildcat strikes, would tend to equalize profits, and would slice through and ultimately resolve the welter of conflicting special conditions that now exist in every port. Teddy Gleason, who later on went to become the president of the International, said about the same time, it has been our position now that all the companies that we have any control over should sit down around the table with us and make a rate for the entire United States. I believe it takes just as much strength to lift 100 pounds of sugar in Tacoma as it does in Baltimore. A docker should get the same money for doing it. So what I wanted to do is, as with Paula, is start off with some of the theory stuff and then to tell you about a couple of strategies, geographical strategies that the ILA adopted in response to containerization of the, at least the East Coast industry in the beginning in the 1950s and going through, obviously, to today. So, as I said, you might be wondering, what is a geographer doing here? I'm sure the idea that there are people called labor historians is fairly obvious and fairly well known, but there are actually a small group of us, and in fact, Paula's advisor, Jane Wills, is in the UK, is one of them, who call ourselves labor geographers. And so, basically, what we're interested in is the idea in which work and workers' lives are socially embedded. You know, all of us are socially embedded, spatially embedded. You know, where we work, we're tied in with particular local communities that themselves are then tied into broader national and global relationships. If I decide to get in my car and drive for 5 minutes, I can cover a greater geographical distance in those 5 minutes than if I walk in 5 minutes. So I think all of us can think about how our lives are geographically, how they're spatially embedded and structured. And so there's a number of what I've called here tenets of what we might call labor geography that I want to just briefly talk about for setting the context for looking at some of the strategies that the ILA adopted in response to containerization, because that's really what I'm interested in, both from an academic point of view, but also from a political point of view. I'm really interested in the issue of strategy and how can we think strategically about improving workers' lives. So there are a number of tenets. The first I've just kind of talked about is the idea that social actors' lives then are geographically, or as using our special language, spatially embedded. And then the idea that how social actors are geographically embedded really then shapes possibilities for their social action. So that we might think about how workers that work for firms that are simply tied into local labour markets have different sets of possibilities open to them than those who work for firms that are much more transnational.
Medicare or worker compensation funds, no Social Security tax, no health insurance, no pension contributions. The trucking company may require this independent operator to report daily to the dispatch office to await work, which means he can't seek work orders from more than one company. If he decides to leave one of the unscrupulous contractors, he will be told that he can leave, but the truck stays behind, so it can be assigned to a replacement driver. Since the lease has remained with the contractor, he has no recourse. Another common scenario is that a driver gets into an accident and only then discovers that the trucking company has not paid to cover him and his truck on its insurance policy. The cost of the accident may drive him into bankruptcy and/or out of the trucking business. Okay, I'm going to step away from our owner-operator for a second. Two trajectories in the political economy of neoliberal globalization intersect to create this story of exploitation. First, there is the growth of trade, in particular the growth of imported goods from China. Since the Clinton and Bush II administrations agreed to support China's entry into the WTO, which was finalized in 2001, Chinese exports to the U.S. have grown from $102 billion to $300 billion, an increase of more than 180% in just 5 years. Not surprisingly, this surge overwhelmed the West Coast ports and forced shippers to begin sending goods originating in China through the Panama Canal to East Coast ports. The East Coast ports used to be almost entirely devoted to trade with across the North Atlantic to Europe and to the Caribbean. So this was a new phenomenon, pretty much. The East Coast ports were ill-prepared for the unexpected flood. Congested docks, jammed highways, and long delays along the nation's inadequate railroad tracks are the result. The explosion in imports might have led to soaring freight rates and rising wages for poor truckers, had not deregulation, which is the second trajectory of neoliberal globalization, taken place in the U.S. beginning in the late 1970s. Carter-Kennedy reforms brought an end to the regulatory regime, which limited the number of trucking companies that could operate on each delivery route, a regime that set freight rates, a regime in which poor truckers were union workers with health insurance, pensions, and industrial workers' wages. After 1981, most drayage companies ceased to be owners of trucks and employers of drivers. Under the new regime, most became brokers with few assets and even fewer responsibilities towards the drivers. Their role is to take orders and schedule pickups and deliveries from port terminals to distribution centers and warehouses, which, as we've heard, may be as far away as 75 miles from the ports, depending on distribution patterns, land prices, and labor costs. For their role in scheduling the truck movements of their contract drivers, they receive at least half of the freight delivery rate. In a generation, port trucking became a scene of destructive competition, which is, again, a phrase which I learned about in studying the 1870s and 1880s. It's a phrase, destructive competition, that faded out of the American vocabulary. But if you read people describing the Gilded Age and the Progressive Era, it's a concept, and the Depression, it's a phrase that was used all the time. We've forgotten what destructive competition is. With virtually no barriers to entry Anyone with a phone and fax machine could become a trucking broker. There are now thousands of these brokers contracting with somewhere between 50,000 and 75,000 owner-operators who constitute 70% of the drayage labor force. The rest are employees. Since these brokers have few, if any, assets or overhead costs, they constantly underbid each other, keeping transportation costs low, but shifting much of the cost of doing business onto surrounding communities like the ones that we just heard about in the form of dirty air, congested and broken roadways, and ubiquitous traffic accidents. As independent contractors, owner-drivers are treated by the law as independent businesses who have no collective bargaining rights. As you heard yesterday from John, they have no power to join together to negotiate higher rates. In fact, drivers have been sued for violating the federal Sherman Antitrust Act, which was passed at the end of the period, the historical period I've been talking about, 1890. They've been sued for violating that act, for going on strike, or for demanding wage hikes. The low rate drivers receive do not allow them to maintain their trucks. The resulting high maintenance costs keep them from accumulating enough savings to afford to replace their aging trucks with newer ones. The newer ones provide better fuel economy and much less diesel emissions, but the drivers can't afford them. Lack of health insurance means that when a driver or a member of his family gets sick, the driver cannot afford to remain in a job without benefits. As tens of thousands of formerly Teamster Union drivers left the industry, they were replaced by workers with the fewest options. Immigrants from India and Pakistan and Seattle and Vancouver, from Central America and Mexico and California, from Cuba and Miami, and from Latin America, Africa, and Asia in New Jersey. Studies by researchers at the West Coast ports, one of whom is going to be speaking in a few minutes after me, shows that the driver's net pay averages less than $11 an hour without benefits for work weeks that it can exceed 60 hours. This is a wage level 30% below what union members earned when drayage was regulated. When you factor in benefits, the income loss exceeds 50%. I just want to talk a little bit about what it means to work 60 hours on congested highways and aging diesel fume spewing trucks. Because the daily experience is worse than what that sounds like, because port truckers are not paid for their time but for the load. The operators of terminals, trucking firms, distribution centers, and warehouses have no incentive to invest in technology or to streamline systems so that drivers can maximize the number of deliveries they make per day. Instead, drivers wait on lines to get through the terminal gates, to pick up the chassis on which their loads will sit, to exit the ports with their boxes inspected, to drive through bottlenecks at ramps and bridges leading to and from the port, to deliver and pick up boxes at the loading docks of distribution centers and warehouses. Waiting online, losing time, breathing in diesel fumes from old outmoded trucks leads to disabling stress, heart and lung disease and cancer. But nobody knows how much because no one has bothered to study the health impacts on these drivers who sit on the bottom of the American logistics supply chain. I understand that there is a study that the National Resources Defense Council is doing about the impact of these conditions on the health of poor truckers in Oakland, but that study isn't out. I've been talking to everybody I can think of in the last year about getting a study of the health impacts on drivers in New Jersey, because when I meet with them, it becomes immediately clear that there are terrible health impacts, but I haven't found anybody who's willing to pay for it yet. The fact that drivers are not paid for their waiting time takes a toll not only on their health, but on the efficiency of the logistics chain itself. Since their extra low earnings means that freight rates have remained low, despite the rapid increase in shipping volumes, logistics firms have little incentive to invest in modern equipment to speed up the movement of the trucks carrying containers into and out of the port. In most of America's ports, the chassis which carry containers are old, and the traffic software which manages the flow of the freight and the trucks and the railroads is outdated. Freight rates are so low that it is economical for shippers to let their containers sit around at the terminal yards for up to 3 days awaiting pickup and delivery. And some of the containers sit even longer, using the wharves as outdoor warehouses, accumulating late fees. These boxes take up space and clutter the yards, which also means that there are more accidents in the yards than there need to be. Because the freight rates are so low for the containers moving slowly through the congested terminals and highways, most customers don't insist on just-in-time delivery, for which they would have to pay a premium. At a conference last year, Nelson explained to me that Walmart does pay that premium because they want to have just-in-time delivery, but most of the companies in the U.S. don't do it because they find the cheap freight rates to be an adequate substitute. As a result, these shippers have higher inventory and insurance costs, and they lose potential profits when they have to discount items that arrived at the stores too late to satisfy customer demands. If they get the product when people are no longer willing to pay full price for them, they may have to sell them for a 50% discount, which is good for us when we go to Macy's, but it cuts into their profits. And I think that's another cost that you have to factor into when you think about how, when you're trying to calculate how inefficient the logistics industry is because of the weakness of the port trucking sector. The costs of destructive competition are borne directly by the public in two ways. First, drivers without health insurance have to rely on public hospitals for state-paid emergency medical care. The cost of this emergency care has been rising rapidly, causing state governments to cut back on aid to education, road repair, and housing. And second, the fact that trucking companies don't have to contribute to Social Security to make payments to workers' compensation funds or to make pension contributions intensifies the negative impact on public program budgets. Yet these costs are probably minor when compared to the costs imposed by the negative health impacts of heavy diesel emissions from tens of thousands of trucks with dirty, obsolete engines. In California, researchers estimated that the health impacts of these port-related emissions amount to $19 billion per year. And a study conducted by the New Jersey Environmental Justice Federation on diesel emissions in the ironbound section of Newark projected that by 2010, the cost of the health impacts on community residents from diesel soot would cost New Jersey almost $5 billion annually. Asthma, high death rates from cancer, days missed from work and school, high blood pressure, heart disease, these constitute the toll borne by residents of New Jersey's 11 counties. And if you look on a map, you'll see that those 11 counties that are out of compliance with federal air quality standard are right along the truck routes. People in New Jersey, I don't really think, understand that their state is out of compliance with federal air quality standards, despite the efforts of the environmental movement to publicize that. In California, the destructive competition in port trucking reached such crisis proportions that residents of communities blighted by dirty air from ships, old trucks, and old diesel train engines organized to insist that something be done to clear the air. John talked about that yesterday. The resistance to the proposals to clean the air have been fierce, as you would expect. Logistics-related businesses are resisting the plans. They want the public to subsidize retrofitting of old truck engines, and they desperately want to keep Teamsters out of the ports. They are not only lobbying against the Clean Air Plan, they are threatening to tie up the reform process with lawsuits challenging the port's authority to set standards for port trucking. On October 23rd, the Bush administration weighed in, and I bet you could predict what they said. The Department of Transportation's Maritime Coordinator, Sean Connaughton, sent a letter to the director of the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach supporting the logistics industry's concerns about the plan to require that trucking companies employ their drivers, and he threatened litigation if the plans go forward. We haven't gotten that far in New Jersey. Environmentalists and labor and faith-based groups and community groups in New Jersey have gotten together to form a what we call the Coalition for Healthy Ports. But we're just at the beginning stages of a process which in California has been going on for probably more than a decade. And so far, organizations like the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey haven't taken the concerns about the externalities of the growth of freight very seriously. Community and environmental groups are reaching out across the country to put excessive diesel emissions from dirty trucks and dockyard equipment and ships and tugboats on the agenda of the national movement to reduce greenhouse gases and meet air quality standards. So about a month ago, three community leaders from the Inland Empire came to New Jersey and asked someone from Change to Win to introduce them to people in the community who are concerned about the environmental impacts. The person from Change to Win called me, and I brought them over to St. Joseph's Social Service Center in Elizabeth, where they talked about how they had been organizing their communities. And the sister Jacinta at St. Joseph's and one of her young staff people got interested enough so that now one of the staff people is planning to come out here on November 30th to attend this conference. I think that before that meeting, the people in Elizabeth had felt like unemployment and homelessness were such profound problems in their communities that they weren't able to take the air pollution problems seriously. And I think they've just learned in the last few weeks that they need to take them seriously as well. This issue about how an unregulated logistics sector is affecting the public is starting to provoke national action. Okay. I'm just about at the end. Change to Win has made organizing the nation's owner-operators one of its five top priorities. In some states like New York and Illinois, the departments of labor are starting to move against misclassification. Patricia Smith, the commissioner of labor in New York, announced on May 3rd the creation of an immigrants' rights bureau within the Department of Labor to be staffed by 10 new labor standards inspectors who are proficient in Spanish and Korean. The bureau is liaising with immigrant groups throughout the state to ferret out the most egregious labor law violators. So the My conclusion is that the destructive competition of port trucking labor market is a vivid example of how neoliberal globalization's unregulated growth is unsustainable. And now there are efforts to put this issue on the national agenda. Progressive think tanks like Demos, the Century Foundation, and the Economic Policy Institute are beginning to ask whether it's time to put effective regulation back after 30 years of neglect. I want to end with, by saying that the California Clean Air Action Plan is a good example of what a new balance between the economy and the public welfare would look like, setting standards for the environment, for community accountability, for decent jobs, and for industry efficiency and sustainability. Perhaps more important, the fact that environmental, public health, labor, and community groups have been able to work together successfully to raise public awareness of the issues and to place them high on the public policy agenda is a model for how progressives can confront the challenges presented by the forces of neoliberal globalization and deregulation, which for the past 30 years have combined to degrade America's environment and labor markets.
Thank you, Peter. Thanks very much, David. Our next speaker is Kristen Monaco from Cal State Long Beach.
Advanced technology. I'm actually not going to talk at all about port truck drivers today, which I hope isn't too disappointing, but I talk enough about them that I feel it's getting a little repetitive, so I wanted to do something slightly new, although I can answer any questions about port drivers people might have. What I'm actually doing is sort of stepping on John's turf a little bit. He claims that he studies the ports of LA and Long Beach now because he started with the Inland Empire, is working his way to sort of the source of traffic. What I'm doing is exactly the opposite. Starting thinking about port drivers at the ports of LA and Long Beach got me thinking about people working in logistics in the Inland Empire. Oh, before I go on, this research was funded by a grant from METRANS, which is a DOT-funded transportation research center at USC. So got that out of the way. Obviously, there's a lot of issues that have been raised recently with respect to logistics labor markets. And sort of on one side, you have John and others who really advocate this idea that logistics employment is an answer to the decline of manufacturing. So as manufacturing has employment has declined in California, logistics is sort of the next best alternative, especially for the demographic we're considering. On the other side, you have this literature Edna and Goetz have talked about, which is this idea that logistics workers are underpaid. And I think the third question that's arising now, which is more of a public policy concern, is who are these workers who we rely on to move goods? And obviously, this is coming to the forefront now because of the transportation worker ID card, or the TWIC, which is going to be implemented at the ports any day now, according to Department of Homeland Security, which basically is going to monitor for both criminal background, but also immigration status, which is obviously an issue with port truckers. And obviously, we're also interested in the demographics and economic performance of these workers with respect to the Clean Trucks program, which has been discussed. What I'm really here to present today is sort of some preliminary research, which is a very nice way of saying I'm not quite done with my research, so I threw together a bunch of charts to distract you from that fact. The data really looks at a source slightly different than John. So I'm looking at the micro data sets of both the 2000 census and the 2005 American Community Survey, which is also administered by the census. It's just a smaller sample size, but both are sort of nationally representative. And these are nice data sets because they have information on both labor market data, so wages, hours, industry, occupation, and the location of your job, but also demographics, gender, race and ethnicity, education, and the location of your residence. And these location issues I'm going to touch on a little bit more in a second. The goal is really to sort of take a stab at complementing or bridging existing research, which is this contrast between these are jobs that provide a lot of opportunities and this assertion that these are jobs that provide no opportunities. And I'm not really providing an answer to that, but hopefully providing some information that will help bridge this gap in the research. I think generally it's interesting to look at the labor climate, especially in sort of developing areas, and obviously in Southern California especially, there's a big move to think about environmental justice, which is, as we're affecting these communities through development, how are the residents of these communities being affected? Is this a positive or a negative for them? I'm going to focus on the four county areas, so LA, Orange County, Riverside, and San Bernardino. Riverside and San Bernardino, or otherwise known as the Inland Empire, and really want to describe, starting off, the distributions of jobs and residences. This is sort of, I think, relevant and important because when we talk about job growth, it's important to note whether the jobs that are being developed are actually going to the residents of the communities. We know the residents of the communities are the ones being affected by congestion and pollution and other negative externalities. The question is, are they also the ones who are benefiting from the job growth that's going on? Also want to just look at some basic economic indicators. This is from BEA data. Look at the distribution of occupations and industries that I'm going to call goods movement dependent or logistics dependent, which is really manufacturing, wholesale trade, retail trade, and transportation and warehousing. And then finally, look at the returns to education, which is a big issue. What are the returns to human capital investment in these industries? The first is just this table that my husband tells me is unreadable, but it's basically joint probabilities for where people live and where people work, and it sums up to one. But the idea is that there's this dispersion in Southern California between where people work and where people live. And I'm from the Midwest, so generally in the Midwest, people work where they live, right? And when I moved here and I got a job at Cal State Long Beach, I said to my boss, where should I live? He said, well, you could live in Long Beach or you could live anywhere else, because at the time, none of the faculty members actually lived in Long Beach. And I said, well, this is very odd to me. I thought you were supposed to live where you work. But in Southern California, this is obviously this divergence. And we're just looking at this at the county level. But what we see is that 90% of people who work in LA also live in LA. And that number decreases as we go down. So only 55% of people who work in San Bernardino also live there. Okay, so 45% of the job creation is, in fact, going to people who live outside the area. And we get a similar sort of situation for Riverside. So in looking at this job creation, it's important to sort of touch on, are the residents benefiting? Where are the residents working? What kind of wages are they earning, et cetera? Looking at sort of stuff we know to be true, we know manufacturing in terms of GDP has declined. It seems to be rebounding somewhat. But we know wholesale trade is increasing in terms of our real GDP in the state. Transportation's relatively flat. Retail trade has grown over time. When we look at the percent of GDP generated by these industries, manufacturing relatively flat since early 2000, and a slight increase in wholesale trade, but relatively stable. Switching from GDP to employment, because I think what we care about in terms of job growth is obviously this employment issue. Manufacturing jobs are on the decline. We know manufacturing jobs are on the decline. But what's somewhat surprising here is retail trade, wholesale trade, and transportation warehousing have been relatively stable over the past 5 years, with the exception of San Bernardino County. And this sort of builds upon what John said earlier. This is where we get these job growth in these goods movement-related industries. If we look at the median weekly wages by occupation and industry, so occupation, our broad occupational categories are running down the table and industries across in the columns, we see that transportation warehousing in particular provides decent wages at the managerial and professional level, right? So if the median weekly wage in manufacturing for managers and professionals is $1,250, in transportation and warehousing it's $1,000, which is fairly comparable, right? At the top end of the distribution, people who are professional managers are making what we would expect to be decent wages, regardless of what industry they're in. What we see is a lot more divergence once we change out of those occupational categories to sort of less skilled occupational categories. Okay. What's important also is to think about how many jobs there are in each of these categories. So we see that overall, among everyone employed in the four-county area, 30.8% of all those working in the four-county area are managers or professionals of some sort. When we divide this down by industry, we see a very different pattern. So in manufacturing, 26.9% of workers are managers. When we move down to retail, trade, and transportation and warehousing, only about 12% of the workers are managers or professionals. Okay. There's a lot of people at the bottom generating the jobs at the top end of the distribution. All right. And this is something to think about when we start talking about upward mobility and how we move these people up, is that it takes an awful lot of people at the bottom end of the pyramid to feed up into the managerial positions that are available. And obviously your ability to move up and attain is really a function of your education. Hopefully that's the case. I have a bunch of students in the room, and I think they still believe that education is going to give them some kind of returns. We see, obviously, the educational distribution in LA. John mentioned before, we have a lot of people who are sort of at the high school level or below. About 20% of LA residents have a college degree, 8% have a graduate degree. In Orange County, we get the sort of demographic shift we expect, where we have more people at the higher end of the educational distribution. But when we look at the Inland Empire, as John said, we have a lot of people with a high school diploma or less. Okay, the overwhelming majority of the people who are working don't have a lot of education. Okay, if we look at sort of now the jobs by place of residence, again, the sample is the four-county area. Most people live in L.A. The distribution for logistics industries is about the same distribution we see for all industries as a whole. So about 60% of people working in these good movement-dependent industries live in L.A., 22% in Orange County, 12% in Riverside, 6% in San Bernardino. If we restrict our sample to people who are managers or professionals and look at where these people live, they disproportionately live in Orange County and disproportionately don't live in San Bernardino or Riverside. Okay, so they're sort of underrepresented. You know, what got me thinking about this is I teach in a master's program in global logistics, and the students who come out of there, they're professionals working in logistics, and they get these great jobs afterwards. And they make, you know, obviously a lot more money than I do, but, you know, that's the price we pay for being educators as opposed to sort of crane operators or logistics professionals. But the issue is they all wind up working in San Bernardino, but they don't live in San Bernardino, right? And this is sort of the chasm we get here. If we look at handlers, people who are actually handling the goods in these warehouses and distribution centers, what we see is they overwhelmingly don't live in Orange County, and they disproportionately live in Riverside and San Bernardino, right? So this is sort of what we get. The lower end of the distribution is obviously handlers. So if we think of the two extremes, managers and professionals on the top end of the distribution and handlers on the bottom, again, these are people who are sort of loading pallets, driving forklifts, all the things you think about. The mean earnings are about $12.47 an hour. The median is $9.38 an hour. And when we get this divergence between the mean and the median, what this means is that there's a lot of people at the bottom end of the distribution, and we sort of see their weekly earnings. They comprise 5% of all workers in the